KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
A preliminary intelligence assessment said the U.S. attacks did not totally destroy Iran's nuclear program.
But a new statement from the CIA says that several key Iranian nuclear facilities were destroyed.
For Wednesday, June 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, the U.S. is trying to deport a journalist from El Salvador who was arrested in Georgia while covering a protest.
Right now, the process is trying to get him released so he can be with his family and continue litigating his case.
Also, tens of millions of people are suffering under extreme heat this week.
We'll look at the impact on transportation infrastructure.
And the most talked about performance in London this summer isn't on stage and doesn't require a ticket.
People who maybe, you know, not able to afford to go to the theater, you know, experiencing something which is a live theatrical production.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Speaking today at the now-concluded NATO summit at The Hague, President Donald Trump continued to say the U.S. strike against Iranian nuclear sites this past weekend completely and fully obliterated the country's nuclear capabilities. That's despite an initial U.S. intelligence assessment suggesting it only set back Iran's efforts by a few months. Trump pushed back on that today.
When I saw them starting to question the caliber of the attack, was it bad? Well, it was really bad. It was devastating. They were obliterated. Like, you can't get into the tunnels. They just put that over. That just came out. They can't, there's nothing, there's no way you can even get down. The whole thing is collapsed in a disaster.
Administration officials defended the president, also calling that first assessment preliminary. And late today, there was a rare statement from CIA Director John Ratcliffe saying Iran's nuclear program was, quote, severely damaged by the U.S. airstrikes. The chairman of a vaccine advisory committee for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it will re-examine the number of vaccines kids get. NPR's Ping Wong reports the move represents a possible significant shift in vaccine policy.
The CDC's influential vaccine advisory committee met today with all new members, and a new tone was immediately evident. Martin Kuhldorf, a biostatistician and the chair of the group, says they're considering major changes to the vaccine schedule for kids.
The number of vaccines that our children and adolescents receive today exceed what children in most other developed nations receive.
The committee's recommendations are critical in guiding state and local vaccine policies, along with what insurers cover. 2 weeks ago, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. purged the committee and replaced it with new members. Some of them have expressed skepticism about vaccines. Ping Huang, NPR News, Atlanta.
President Trump's budget director, Russ Vogt, defended the administration's request to claw back more than $9 billion in foreign aid and funding for public media. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports on the next steps in the Senate.
Senators from both parties pressed Vogt about the impact the administration's $1 billion cut for public media would have for emergency services and local news, especially in rural states. Chair Susan Collins says she shares the administration's concerns that some content is ideologically biased, but pointed out most of the money goes to local stations.
There are, however, more targeted approaches to addressing that bias at NPR than rescinding all of the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The House narrowly approved the administration's request, and the Senate has until July 18th to vote. If it fails to approve it, the administration must release the funds for the targeted programs. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 106 points. The Nasdaq closed up 61 points. You're listening to NPR. The dating app Bumble has announced major layoffs. The Philadelphia-based company saying today will lay off about 30% of its employees, or roughly 240 workers. Bumble citing the need to realign operations and saying it expects the move to save the company about $40 million annually. Bumble says it would reinvest much of that in product and technological development. Trump ally Carrie Lake told a House hearing compared and compared the U.S. Agency for Global Media to a rotten fish. She says the agency she's running needs to be scrapped. More from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Democrats on the House Foreign Affairs Committee say Lake is using falsehoods to advance her agenda to dismantle the Voice of America and other U.S.-funded news organizations. Lake spent much of a hearing on this, leveling accusations against the VOA, alleging, for instance, that the Chinese Communist Party has more influence over VOA's content than the U.S. government does.
President Trump has the right idea. We need to eliminate this agency, find what's salvageable, and move it over to the Department of State.
Democrats point out that China and Russia hailed the Trump administration's decision to silence news organizations that broadcast trusted information into repressive countries. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Singer Barbara Streisand will be releasing a new record collaborating with some music legends, including Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, and James Taylor. The album of duets called The Secret of Life Partners Volume 2 is due out later this week. Streisand says in making the record, she had to overcome a voice she described as, quote, shot. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump faced questions today about his assertion that U.S. strikes last weekend totally obliterated facilities where Iran could enrich uranium to weapons-grade levels. A preliminary U.S. intelligence assessment said that the damage appeared to be more limited than that. Then, later today, the CIA weighed in with a statement saying that there's a, quote, body of credible evidence that the damage is indeed severe. That statement from CIA Director John Ratcliffe appears to back what Trump has been saying. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has been following the president's remarks all day and joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Tam.
Good morning, Elsa. And not good morning. Good afternoon.
Time zones are all mixed up. It's okay. How do you see the president grappling with this evolving intel on the strikes?
Well, the president has been quite defensive, saying that anyone who questioned the overwhelming success of Saturday's mission was unfairly maligning the pilots who carried it out. So when the media started reporting on that preliminary intelligence report from the Defense Intelligence Agency, he was not happy. The White House initially said it was a leak meant to undermine the president. Earlier today, Trump did acknowledge that this report exists, but he emphasized that it was very early and that it didn't capture everything that he said he believes to be true about the effectiveness of the strikes.
Okay, so tell us more about this new assessment.
Yet tonight, the White House circulated this statement from the CIA on social media. John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, said there's new intelligence from, quote, a historically reliable and accurate source or method that several key facilities were destroyed and it would take years to rebuild them, which is much closer to how President Trump has been describing it than other outside experts and that earlier assessment that leaked to journalists. Mm-hmm. I should say it is unusual for the CIA to put out any public statements on such sensitive matters. In addition, battle damage assessments can take many days or weeks, so it's unusual to have it so quickly. Here's what President Trump said today about the damage to Iran's nuclear program at a formal press conference at the end of the NATO summit.
Well, it was really bad. It was devastating. They obliterated. Like, you can't get into the tunnels. They just put that over. That just came out. They can't. There's nothing. There's no way you can even get down. The whole thing is collapsed in a disaster.
And just an illustration of the confidence Trump is projecting. He was asked about whether he still intends to negotiate a deal with Iran to halt their nuclear ambitions. And he said he wasn't even sure that would be necessary because the U.S. has destroyed their nuclear program. Politically speaking, President Trump has already declared mission accomplished, and he really isn't interested in getting anything getting in the way of that.
Right. Okay. Well, as the president was speaking from the NATO summit, he said something really remarkable, Tam, about the alliance. Let's just take a listen.
Yeah. It was great. And I left here differently. I left here saying that these people really love their countries. It's not a ripoff. And we're here to help them protect their country.
Tam, what struck you about those remarks?
They were just so warm. This is probably the first time I've heard him say something nice about the alliance. Uh-huh. His feelings about NATO over time have ranged from ambivalence to hostility. Even on the flight over to Europe, he was waffling about what NATO's Article 5 clause means. That's the commitment that an attack on one is an attack on all. In the past, he has said he might not be willing to protect a country that isn't paying its fair share. But at the end of the summit, he expressed the most commitment he ever has to NATO in Article 5, in part because NATO nations agreed to a big hike in their defense spending.
I mean, do you know, like, what happened there to make him change his mind on all of this? Just that hike in defense spending?
That's it. And they figured out how to manage Trump. And getting that big hike in defense spending is something he's been trying to get. It's something American presidents for decades have been trying to get. But Trump is taking credit, though some should probably also go to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who scared them into spending more with the war on Ukraine.
That is NPR's Tamara Key. Thank you so much, Tam.
You're welcome.
A journalist in Georgia who live-streamed his own arrest while covering a No Kings protest about 2 weeks ago is now fighting deportation to El Salvador. Lawyers for Mario Guevara say that he is authorized to work in the U.S. and should be released. But the Department of Homeland Security claims that it has grounds for deportation. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Shemaine Cruz has more.
Mario Guevara is believed to be the only journalist facing deportation under Trump's push for greater immigration enforcement. He is being held in South Georgia's Folkston ICE Processing Center. Giovanni Diaz is his attorney.
Right now the process is trying to get him released so he can be with his family and continue litigating his case.
Guevara was arrested on misdemeanor charges, including obstruction of law enforcement officers and unlawful assembly. His family says they had prepared to welcome him home on Father's Day, but instead, he was transferred from the county jail into ICE custody. Diaz says he expects Guevara will be granted bond early next month.
We're confident that we'll be able to get that hearing as soon as possible.
The Department of Homeland Security says Guevara is in ICE custody because he entered the country illegally in 2004, not because he is a journalist. Guevara has an application pending for a green card through his son, who is a U.S. citizen. Guevara once worked as a reporter for Georgia's largest Spanish-language newspaper, Mundo Hispanico, before launching his own online news site, MG News. His arrest sparked outcry from press freedom organizations, including the Society of Professional Journalists and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists sent a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem calling for his release. Here's the group's Catherine Jacobson.
It seems a waste of resources to hold Guevara, again, who is in the United States legally, in ICE detention and carry out these court proceedings when his initial detention was a violation of his First Amendment rights to be there covering a matter of public interest.
About a week after his arrest, Guevara faced new criminal charges. A local sheriff in another Metro Atlanta county says that in May, he ran a red light while covering a police operation. It's not clear what the new charges could mean for Guevara's immigration case. For NPR News, I'm Shemaine Cruz in Atlanta.
This summer's most talked about performance on London's West End is not actually on stage. Doesn't even require a ticket. NPR's Lauren Freyer explains.
It's kind of a bizarre hour for London's theater district to be hopping. Tourists have all disappeared behind the theater doors. The evening performances are well underway. And yet I am shoulder to shoulder with hundreds of people streaming down to stand in front of the Palladium Theater. There are barricades, the roads are closed to traffic.
Are you going where I'm going?
We're
going
to see Rachel Zegler sing Evita, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
Amy and Mark Bailiff from Fargo, North Dakota, are here for the musical Evita, about the life and times of Eva Perón, Argentina's first lady in the 1940s and early 50s. The lead role is played by Ziegler, who was in Disney's Snow White movie.
She's Snow White. What was she in?
West Side Story.
There we go.
I got the wrong Rachel Ziegler trivia.
But the Bailiff family does not have tickets. They're here to see what Ziegler does outside the theater. Around 9 p.m. at the start of Act 2, Andrew Lloyd Webber's soundtrack gets piped out onto the street, and the star emerges on a balcony. To sing the musical's signature song to passersby in the street. Just like the real Eva Perón, who appealed to Argentina's masses and peasants, the masses here, that's all of us in the crowd, essentially become on-camera extras, because the whole scene is live-streamed back into the theater for those who actually have tickets.
I think it's quite cool to make people outside a prop in the show, so that's quite unique for me.
We'll be on the screen on our West End debut.
Londoners Jamie Ball and Alana Carlton and practically everyone else I meet here heard about this only one way.
Online.
Yeah, just on TikTok. I feel like everyone has. It's all over TikTok.
Now, normally, if you film a show and post it on social media, it can get taken down for copyright issues. But that has not been the case here.
I'm very, very excited that this scene at the Palladium has had 50 million views so far on TikTok. 50 million.
This is the owner of the Palladium, whose name is Andrew Lloyd Webber. Yes, the Andrew Lloyd Webber. He wrote the music, owns the theater, collaborated with director Jamie Lloyd, no relation, and even petitioned the city to close the street out front.
It took quite a lot of negotiation, I can tell you.
Now, this is signature Lloyd and Lloyd Webber, whose New York production of the musical Sunset Boulevard had one of the characters walk out of the theater and stroll down Broadway singing. Lloyd Webber admits he does worry, though. If crowds keep doubling in size every night here, as they have been, it looked like 1,000 people when I went.
I slightly wake up at night thinking, if it gets any bigger, are they going to say, look, this is getting a little bit out of hand? But it's 1,000 people who may be, you know, not able to afford to go to the theatre, you know, experiencing something which is a live theatrical production. And I think that's fantastic.
As for the people inside the theater, some of whom paid hundreds for a ticket to end up watching that famous scene only on a screen. A few people did come out of the theater grumbling.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
But others were singing.
With this, I never left you.
And some say they'll just come back tomorrow night and stand outside.
I kept my promise.
Don't keep your distance.
Lauren Freyer, NPR News on London's West End.
And as for fortune, and as for fame, I never reminded them it. Though it seemed to the world they were all I desired, they are illusions.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Tens of millions of people across the United States are currently under a heat advisory, and the extreme heat isn't just affecting people. You may have seen videos online of the heat causing asphalt roads to buckle, creating bumps in the ground. The heat is impacting rail travel, too. Amtrak has been running some of its trains more slowly, as have the public transit systems in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. Mikhail Chester has thought a lot about extreme heat and transportation. He's an engineering professor at Arizona State University, where he studies the impacts of climate change on transportation infrastructure. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Okay. I'd love to start, if we can, with roads and trains. Can you start by just telling us briefly, how does extreme heat affect train tracks, for example, or make the road expand? What exactly is happening there?
Yeah. So there's sort of two dynamics to think about. One is the impact directly to the infrastructure itself. And in many ways, we've designed our infrastructures over decades, if not centuries, for temperatures that have been relatively milder. So when it comes to a road, we design roads with a particular temperature extreme in mind, depending on the particular location where that road is built and maintained. And now as temperatures are hotter, you're starting to see the dynamics of those extremes take hold, exceeding the design thresholds of those infrastructures and the particular assets. So you might experience more cracking and rutting when it comes to a road. When it comes to rail, you might experience that the thresholds, the thermal expansion joints of the rail tracks are being exceeded. And even if the infrastructure itself is not impacted, simply the threat of the failure is resulting in transit agencies or transportation agencies in general having to look out for these threats.
We've talked a little bit about roads and trains, but are there other examples you could give us about ways that extreme heat can impact the country's transportation infrastructure and the people who depend on it?
Sure. So you have started to see stories pop up of airport impacts to service operations where, you know, planes and pilots are told to essentially adjust how much distance they need to take off. And that has had an impact on service and operations. But also there's a human side to this. So people who operate transportation infrastructure who are outside also are impacted by these heat waves. You know, we need to keep them in reprieve for a little bit longer and make sure that, you know, they are ultimately safe. A common story that we might hear about is how passengers on transit vehicles, for example, might be more unruly more often, leading to police intervention. So all of these things are at play and ultimately may have some impact into the service.
So, Mikhail, to your mind, is this a moment to say that we need to change our approach?
Correct. Now is a time when we're starting to see innovation emerge and also limitations of how much we can engineer ourselves using existing models of how we typically approach infrastructure. Whereas in the past, we may have said, we'll simply update to hotter temperatures in how we design. The challenge of doing that is there's so much infrastructure out there and the costs of rehabilitating all might be quite expensive. And as such, we're starting to see folks ask this question of what could we do differently?
I wonder if you have a message to policymakers or others who are approving budgets in order to make cities more resilient. Is there one thing in particular they should think about as they're trying to figure out how to address this?
I would say that as we enter this period where we're experiencing these climate hazards, heat and otherwise, we're starting to see that there's a major market for producing knowledge to be able to address these challenges. Often, the way that we've been doing it in the past doesn't seem to be sufficient for how we need to approach infrastructure in the future. We need to pivot how we're approaching this challenge. And that's going to require us to innovate, which we are doing. It's going to require us to share that knowledge, which we're starting to do.
One thing you said that really stuck with me is the fact that, yes, this is about infrastructure in terms of rails and roads and buses and cars, but it is also about the people who are doing the work, the people who are helping us all get from place to place and operating these transit systems. I wonder, is there something that can be done to protect those people in this moment where climate change is making life on planet Earth hotter for all of us?
We need to make sure that we have the latest knowledge and science to be able to protect them. For example, how long is it safe for them to be outside in heat waves relative to how long do they need to come into air conditioning for reprieve? Secondly, arming them with the appropriate knowledge of how they should respond to these disasters and threats becomes really important.
That's Mikhail Chester, engineering professor at Arizona State University. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This week, the U.S. brokered a ceasefire between Israel and Iran. Before that, more than 600 people were killed in Iran and 24 in Israel, according to those two countries. Today, Israel opened up again, returning somewhat to routine. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
There's life in the streets again. Restaurants are back open. Friends are swapping stories from their time running to bomb shelters, the miklat. Schools and businesses reopened. Joggers are back crowding the boardwalk. For 12 days, Israelis across the country would run to shelters several times a day and wait for the loud thuds of missiles that made apartments shake and windows shatter. Hadas Givon sits on a bench in a trendy Tel Aviv neighborhood.
In a way, not needing to just run to the shelter, there is some kind of relief. But still, it's very weird.
Israel was bombarded by sophisticated missiles, many of them evading air defenses, hitting a hospital, a prestigious scientific research center, sensitive military sites, residential buildings. Today, Israelis are hearing contradictory claims from the U.S. and Israel about whether Iran's nuclear program was obliterated or just set back months or years. Givon says it gives her a bad feeling.
It feels like this was all a warm-up for the Third World War. Some people say we haven't eliminated their nuclear abilities, so you don't know what will happen next. Now that they know what we can do and what was our abilities, they can prepare for the next thing better. So in that sense, I'm more scared.
In a nod to the fears, Israel's top spymaster issued a rare video statement today. David Barnea, the chief of the Mossad, reflected on years of a shadow war with Iran that he said has scored a victory. Israel, thanks to the entire security apparatus, feels today like a different country, he told Mossad agents. A more secure country, a stronger country that is ready for the future. Israel reopened its airport today, but most foreign airlines have not resumed flights yet. And many here hope the ceasefire with Iran can bring new momentum to Israel and Hamas to finally strike a deal to end the war in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
President Trump has a lot on his plate. His budget bill, the heart of his domestic agenda, is facing pushback in the Senate as lawmakers face a July 4th deadline to pass it. The president has another deadline to unpause double-digit tariffs on more than 60 countries. And that's not all. He's also dealing with a conflict between Iran and Israel, one which he chose to intervene in. So how is Trump dealing with all that pressure? That story in the next morning edition from NPR News. We'll be right back.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Hey, Elsa. Sup, bruh?
Oh my God, don't ever call me that again, Ari.
Okay, but bruh actually has a very long history.
We have examples of this going back to the 16th century. As a title, usually prefixed either to a man's name or to a character.
First this news, bruh.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dwayne Brown. Israel is returning to routine as a ceasefire with Iran continues to hold. Israel's international airport has reopened, but most airlines have not yet resumed flights. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
During the week-and-a-half war Israel launched against Iran, Israeli authorities had shut down schools, airports, and workplaces because of Iranian missile fire that killed 28 people in Israel, according to authorities. Now, schools, businesses, and the U.S. Embassy in Israel have reopened. Israel's airport in Tel Aviv has reopened, but most foreign carriers have not yet resumed flights. Tens of thousands of Israelis abroad are struggling to book flights to return home. Officials say more than 15,000 people were evacuated from their homes in Israel because missile fire destroyed and damaged buildings. There are still restrictions on public gatherings near the border with Gaza because of Israel's ongoing offensive there. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Trump administration is suing federal judges in Maryland over an order that prevents the immediate removal of detained migrants. It's the latest move in the administration's clash with the federal judiciary. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
The Trump administration filed the lawsuit against 15 federal judges in the District of Maryland. The administration is challenging a standing rule put in place by the district's chief judge that automatically blocks on a limited temporary basis the government from deporting migrants in Maryland who file suit challenging their detention. The administration says the rule impedes the power of the White House to enforce immigration laws and is an unlawful attempt to restrain the executive branch. The unusual suit was filed in the court the administration is suing, so the Justice Department is requesting that the case be presided over by a federal judge from another district. The court in Maryland declined to comment. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 106 points. This is NPR. The National Science Foundation will have to move out of its headquarters in Virginia because the Department of Housing and Urban Development will be moving in. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports it's just the latest big change for staffers.
The head of the NSF resigned earlier this year, shortly before the Trump administration called for axing more than half the agency's budget. Now, NSF's approximately 1,800 workers have learned that HUD will be taking over their building. Michael Peters is the Public Buildings Service Commissioner of the U.S. General Services Administration. At a press briefing, he said that HUD's current home is dilapidated and requires too much money to maintain, that this move will improve life for HUD staffers.
We're going to continue to support the National Science Foundation as we support, you know, every agency.
He said the timing of the transition and where NSF will go is still being worked out. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The Bumble dating app plans to lay off about 240 workers as it tries to realign its operations. Bumble launched in 2017 and allows users to swipe left to reject a potential date or swipe right to indicate interest. The dating app expects the layoffs to save up to $40 million a year that will be reinvested into technology. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 106 points. The tech-heavy NASDAQ gained 61 points, up about 0.3%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. are still sweating under a dangerous heat dome. Very hot, humid weather is lingering across much of the eastern half of the country. And climate change, of course, plays a big role in all of this. Rebecca Hersher from NPR's Climate Desk is here with more. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so let's start with what's been happening this week. Like, how unusual is this weather now, even these days?
It's unusual. You know, this heat wave is more intense and just bigger than what we would usually see this time of year. A huge swath of the country is trapped under this heat dome. It's from New England all the way over to, like, Missouri, down to the Carolinas, up to Pennsylvania. And the temperatures are really, really high. More than 30 million people live in areas that saw triple-digit heat on Tuesday, 100 degrees or higher. And that's just really weird for June.
For June. Okay, so how much hotter is it exactly?
A lot. A bunch of records fell on Tuesday. So it was the hottest June day ever recorded in Boston. That city all the way up there hit 102 degrees. Philadelphia had its second hottest June day ever recorded, 101 degrees. And Newark, New Jersey hit 103 degrees, which is actually tied for its previous record for June. So it's abnormally hot in a lot of places, and it's not a mystery why this is happening. You know, climate change is causing intense heat waves like this.
Yeah, I feel like we keep having the same conversation because some amount of hot weather is, of course, normal in the summer, even extremely hot weather. So how do we know that climate change affects this?
Well, yeah, you're right. Really hot weather has always happened, but this kind of intense heat wave used to be really rare, as recently as like the 1950s, before the climate changed dramatically. Now it's pretty common. That's why every summer it feels like a broken record. You'll hear me on the radio like this, reporting on record-breaking heat events all over the country and all over the world. Here's one way to think about what's happening, though. Scientists have crunched the numbers and found that heat waves in the U.S. are 3 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit hotter now than they would have been without climate change. And just those few degrees make a really big difference when you're talking about, like, 92 versus 97 degree weather.
Yeah.
You know, that extra heat from climate change, it can create a really oppressive and dangerous situation. And in fact, this is wild to me, the most intense heat waves that are happening now would actually be virtually impossible without climate change, according to scientists.
Is that true of this heat dome in particular? Like, is it only possible because of climate change?
We don't know yet. Scientists can only assess that after the heat breaks, and then they can kind of measure how much climate change affected this heat wave. What we do know is that weather like this is getting more common every year because the Earth is still heating up. Humans are still releasing huge amounts of carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere, trapping more and more heat. So unless humans reverse that trend, the weather will keep getting hotter and heat waves will just get more and more extreme.
So how can people better protect themselves from extreme heat like this?
It's pretty simple, honestly. Drink a lot of water, stay inside in air-conditioned spaces during the hottest part of the day. If you're going to exercise, do it early in the morning before it heats up too much. Check on people who are vulnerable. That's older folks, people who live alone. People who work outside absolutely need water breaks and shade. On the hottest days, it might not be safe to work outside, period. And, you know, heat, it's one of the deadliest types of weather, but heat deaths are actually entirely preventable.
That is NPR's Rebecca Hersher. Thank you, Becky.
Thanks.
As the Trump administration moves to strip the name of civil rights icon Harvey Milk from a Navy ship, critics worry this decision is part of a larger backlash against LGBTQ people. Steve Walsh from member station WHRO in Norfolk has the story.
To one sailor, the USNS Milk was part of the bond with his Navy family.
I remember as soon as that happened,
a lot of sailors, veterans landed up in Hillcrest, celebrated. We felt seen, recognized that a trailblazer like Harvey Milk was finally being recognized.
The lead petty officer is stationed in Norfolk. It's the current home of the ship named after the gay civil rights leader Harvey Milk. The sailor did not want his name to be used for fear of reprisals. He was stationed in San Diego on the day the ship was christened, on November 6, 2021.
Me and my group, we wore our Navy command shirt, had our little ball caps on, thinking we're cool representing the Navy out here. It was a big deal for us.
It was a point of pride in his Navy career. He left California years earlier to join the Navy to escape a religious family who he did not believe would support him if he came out. Recently, when stories emerged that the Navy plans to remove Milk's name from the ship...
It was a punch to my gut. I was actually on the phone with a friend, and she's the one who told me. I looked it up, and I started crying.
He plans to finish his 20-year career in the Navy, but he says he has talked to junior sailors who say they plan to leave. After watching transgender troops being forced out, they worry this could be the beginning of a larger strategy to push LGBTQ troops out of the military.
How can I stand in front of my sailors, give them 150% of me, when at any point in time, the coin can flip and I could be next? I could be the next one that they don't want in, just for being gay.
Before becoming a San Francisco supervisor, Milk was a Navy dive instructor in the 1950s until he was forced out because of his sexuality. USNS Harvey Milk was the second ship in the John Lewis class of Navy oilers. It was decided during the Obama administration that they would be named for civil rights icons. The names of other ships in the class are also under scrutiny, including a ship named after Thurgood Marshall.
If we politicize this process, which is largely what they are doing, then it turns into a tit for tat.
Carlos Del Toro was Navy Secretary when the Milk was commissioned in 2021.
And so the next time you have a Democratic administration in place, for example, they could reverse the decisions made by the Republican administration.
He says the decision by the Trump administration is different from the congressionally mandated process which required the services to remove the names of Confederate icons, which led the Navy to take the typically unusual step of renaming the USS Chancellorsville. An analysis by the Center for American Progress estimates there are roughly 79,000 LGBTQ people serving in the military. Announcing the decision during Pride Month seems calibrated to send a message, Del Toro says.
It seems extremely vindictive to do it on that month. It's almost as if they want to impact pain on these individuals, emotional pain on them. It's just very, very unfortunate.
In a statement on the renaming, Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell says Secretary Hegseth is committed to ensuring that all the names attached to all DOD installations and assets are reflective of the Commander-in-Chief's priorities. There has been no announcement that the ship renaming has officially happened or what the new name might be. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. New York City's next mayor could be a Democratic socialist in his early 30s. Zoran Mamdani is very likely to be named the Democratic nominee for mayor after a stunning upset Tuesday night. That would put him on the ballot for November's general election. NPR's Rachel Treisman reports on what Mamdani's success would mean for New York City and the country.
Zoran Mamdani was a relatively unknown state assembly member representing Queens when he launched his campaign for mayor last fall. He was an underdog in a crowded Democratic primary. For months, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo led in the polls. But Cuomo called Mamdani to concede on Tuesday night before the race was called. Mamdani declared victory at a watch party full of supporters.
8 months after launching this campaign, with the vision of a city that every New Yorker could afford, we have won.
Mamdani's campaign got help from tens of thousands of volunteers and endorsements from the likes of Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Mamdani used social media to share interactions with New Yorkers and promote his policy goals. Those include rent freezes, free buses, universal childcare, city-owned grocery stores, and higher taxes on the wealthy and corporations.
He won with a really progressive, liberal, left-wing platform of the kind that we probably haven't ever seen in New York.
Patrick Egan is a professor of politics and public policy at New York University. He credits Mamdani with distilling complex problems into simple proposals.
That is well suited for this particular age of social media, where people of all kinds, especially young people, are consuming political news in very short clips.
Mamdani, who was born in Uganda, became a citizen in 2018. If elected, the now 33-year-old would be New York City's first Muslim mayor and its youngest in over a century. Here's Seth Maskett, a professor of political science at the University of Denver.
A lot of Democratic voters seem to be souring on the party's leadership, the party's establishment, and are looking for unusual different voices to lead them going forward, and certainly a younger set of leaders.
Maskett says Democrats in New York and beyond are disillusioned with the party because of their 2024 election losses and what they see as a weak response to President Trump.
I think what we're seeing from this election this year is that the party establishment might not be able to protect its incumbents so well.
But Egan of NYU cautions that what works for Mamdani may not work for Democrats elsewhere.
I think it would be a mistake for either observers or party leaders to say, oh, this has to be the recipe that's going to fit all elections, all constituencies.
And there are still a lot of unknowns in New York City. Mamdani could face Cuomo again in November's general election. The former governor hasn't ruled out running as an independent. Eric Adams, New York City's current mayor, is running for re-election as an independent too. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Germany has a complicated relationship with its military. Two world wars when the country was on the wrong side of history have taught Germans to be cautious about the pitfalls of a big army. But with a war on European soil and a U.S. president who is less committed to defending Europe, Germany, Europe's largest economy, is stepping up. NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Just 6 weeks into his current term in office, President Trump was asked a question about countries like Germany, which for years have not paid 2% of their GDP on defending themselves, a requirement of all NATO countries. He was so eager to answer that he interrupted the reporter.
Well, I think it's common sense, right? If they don't pay, I'm not going to defend them.
A new Trump presidency and an ongoing war on European soil has pushed Germany, a country that for the better part of two decades spent around a single percent of its GDP on its beleaguered military, to finally change its constitution in order to spend more. Just weeks after Trump's comments, incoming German Chancellor Friedrich Merz gave what many observers saw as an historic speech to Parliament.
Die Stärkung der Bundeswehr steht dabei für uns an erster Stelle in der eigenen Politik.
Building up our military, said Merz, is our top priority. From now on, the federal government will provide the military with as much money as it needs to ensure it becomes Europe's strongest armed force. We are Europe's most populous country and Europe's biggest economy, and nothing less should be expected from us. Our partners, said Merz, not only expect this, they demand it.
So this sense of urgency made a decision possible that was unthinkable before.
Claudia Major is a political scientist at the Berlin office of the German Marshall Fund. She says the German government's plan to, over the next decade, spend 3.5% of its GDP on defense, a percentage equal to that of the United States, is a bold move.
But we also know that the DNA of a country, the way how a country, the citizens behave in defense, how they see military force, how they see their armed forces, takes years and decades to change. Normally we say it takes a generation.
But some parts of German society are more ready than others for this historic change. Inside an assembly room in an industrial park outside Munich, a worker tests a drone. It's called a Vector, and for Quantum Systems, it's their best-selling drone, says Director of Operations Alexandra Rietzenbach.
It's our dual-use product. It's used on the one hand in Ukraine. It's also used for the German armed forces. It also is used in Europe in general in different organizations like police, like border control.
The Vector has rotating propellers that enable it to go up and down like a helicopter and then shift into what's called glide mode, like a plane.
So if you go into the gliding mode, you have much more capability to fly longer distances, right, to use the circumstances in the air for saving energy.
Rietzenbach says Ukrainian troops rely on the Vector and the company's other drones to gain a military advantage against invading Russian troops. As a result, she says sales have picked up from selling 200 Vectors in 2023.
Last year, we more than tripled. So for this year, we have also the aim to sell around about 1,500 to 2,000 Vectors. So sales is running smoothly.
And while business for German defense companies like Quantum Systems look promising, the country's defense spending boost might take some time when it comes to rebuilding a culture of military service. That starts here at a job fair in Berlin, where the Bundeswehr, Germany's armed forces, has set up a recruiting booth.
Früher habe ich nie gehört, thank you for service. Das ist heute wirklich immer mal wieder der Fall. Das sollte irgendwie.
Recruitment officer Marco Mann says in his 18 years of recruiting at fairs like this one, he never used to hear thank you for your service. But that's starting to change, he says. People are thanking us for our support of Ukraine, thanking us for being here. It's a nice change, he says. Abdul Rahman Saeed is one of those gracious job seekers at this fair. He's 32, born in Pakistan, but has lived in Germany for a decade and is a German citizen. He's interested in joining the Bundeswehr as an IT specialist.
It's not about going to the battlefield, but as a preemptive measure to actually help them if they are trying to do something and might be they need someone with the cyber security, because everything is now cyber war.
Rahman Saeed says Germany has given him a free education, affordable health care, opportunities.
I feel personally responsible to provide back to the society because Germany gave me a life I wanted.
And in return, he says, if he gets job security, then joining the Bundeswehr is a win-win. And as the Bundeswehr has more money and begins the challenging process of recruiting more personnel, it hopes to gain prestige both domestically as well as internationally. A return to the days when Germany helped maintain security for itself and for Europe. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Have you ever been personally victimized by your Gen Alpha kids who no longer call you mom or dad, but instead call you bruh? Well, we can't help you there, but NPR's Jacqueline Diaz can help explain the origin story of this word.
NPR editor Alina Hartunian was at her Arizona home recently, and her 10-year-old daughter called out to her from her room. She used language Hartunian had never heard before.
It was downstairs. I was in a hallway. And instead of saying mom, she said bruh. It was very jarring.
Bruh. It's become a word used heavily on social media, TikTok especially. But where does this word even come from? Here's Jesse Scheidlauer, the former editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary.
There are a number of different words that abbreviate brother. So these include bro, bra, bruh.
That's probably pretty obvious, but you may be surprised how far back the use of bro and bruh actually goes.
We have examples of this going back to the 16th century. As a title, usually prefixed either to a man's name or to a character, especially the name of an animal in African-American folklore.
The first known use of the word bruh appeared much later in the 1890s, according to Merriam-Webster. Back then, it was spelled B-R-E-R and comes from the Br'er Rabbit, or Bruh Rabbit, a series of stories by Joel Chandler Harris that were taken from African-American folklore. To understand how bruh came to be, Amanda Brennan, who's known as the internet librarian, says we should also take a look at the 2010s and how we used bro. That era brought us the Jersey Shore, which gave us this.
Come at me, bro. Come at me. I'm right here.
And a host of other examples. Brennan has worked on the history of how memes evolved.
I think B-R-O, bro, and B-R-U-H, bruh, have kind of become one word, even though they may have had different origin stories.
As far as we know, bruh itself came to us from the short-lived video app called Vine. 12 years ago, a high school basketball player, Tony Farmer, collapsed after hearing his sentence for assaulting his girlfriend. A creator on Vine used this clip and put this sound effect,
bruh,
as Farmer collapsed. Now, bruh is being used widely by a younger generation in all kinds of ways, too.
Depending on how you say it and who it's said to in the context, it can mean anything.
So for confused parents, Brennan suggests you look for context clues. You'll figure it out. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered, bruh.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to...
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
We want to get Wenton's daddy up here, Ellis Marcellus, to play with Wenton. Let's see if we can get him up here to do that. Yeah? Come on, let's have it.